Hello, and welcome back to the Full Circle Healing Podcast, where we merge modern cutting-edge science with traditional healing wisdom and everything in between to help you come full circle back to your original natural state of health and well-being. I'm your host, Michael, and over the past 15 years, I've helped hundreds of thousands of people find the information, practices, tools, resources, and experts they needed to find their way back to optimal health. Our guest in this episode is our friend and resident hormone expert, Dr. Liz Bartman. Dr. Liz is a naturopathic doctor with over a decade's worth of experience in functional medicine and currently serves as the Director of Clinical Sciences at EndoAxis. Dr. Liz is also well-versed in conventional standards of care and enjoys bridging the gaps of treatment and research in both the conventional and functional fields to provide tailored, evidence-based therapies to her patients. Having previously worked as an educational consultant at Precision Analytical, she's educated and consulted with physicians from around the world on complex hormone cases and has spoken professionally about hormone health, environmental toxin impact on health, and nutrigenomic medicine. In this episode, you're going to learn about the three main types of hormone testing and discover which ones might be the most accurate and useful for you. You're going to gain clarity on why standard blood tests might not be telling the whole story about your hormone health. You're going to understand how hormones like estrogen and testosterone fluctuate throughout the day and the month and why timing your tests is crucial. And Dr. Liz will share a few very simple lifestyle changes that can significantly improve your hormone balance. This and much more. And if you find this topic interesting, head over to rebelhealth.co/hormones to gain immediate access to an in-depth training on the gut microbiome hormone connection featuring microbiologist Kiran Krishnan. The critical role our microbiome plays in regulating and maintaining healthy hormone balance cannot be overstated, and you'll learn more there along with what you can do to optimize things naturally. And now, let's get going with Dr. Liz. And we're live. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Liz.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. And we're going to talk about a topic that a lot of people are interested in, that we get a lot of questions about, that there tends to be a little bit of confusion about. So it'll be good to kind of clear up some questions that we have talking about hormones. And I think where we should probably start is when we're talking about hormones today, in regards to hormone testing and everything to do with that, and possibly a little bit on bioidentical hormones, what hormones specifically are we probably going to be focusing on?
Primary sex hormones are going to be testosterone, estrogen, progesterone. And okay, we can start looking at those metabolites as well, but those are really the primary parent hormones.
Okay, so when we're talking about hormone, and in regards to this conversation, we're going to be talking about testosterone, estrogen, and progesterone largely. There's a lot of other hormones that exist, and some are a lot more complex to test and aren't tested very often. And some, it's just a completely different conversation. So for the purposes of this conversation, we're talking about sex hormones, estrogen, testosterone, and progesterone. Before we get into the types of testing and pros and cons and that, who may want to consider listening to this conversation? Like, who might be a good candidate for hormone testing?
Everyone, as soon as you're of cycling age for a female or in your 20s as a male, you have hormones prolifically in your body and they're resulting in all sorts of symptoms. And I think in this day and age, there's so many features that we have outside of our bodies that are mimicking those sex hormones that can result in all sorts of funky symptoms. So, you know, young women who have heavy menstrual periods, women with PMS symptoms, that kind of fibrocystic breasts, mood changes right around their cycles. Anyone with acne that could be more hormonally driven. And then when you're looking at our, you know, kind of middle-aged 40s, 50-year-olds, when hormones start to fluctuate again. So you're getting this different shift for both men and women from learning about their hormones and when to test and how to test. And yeah, okay. That's a broad answer. Everyone.
Well, yeah, it's true, because we may get into this a little bit too. The hormones are kind of canaries in coal mine a little bit too. They're not necessarily where the problem began. It's how the problem presents itself and then causes a lot more. It might be the thing that'll get your attention, because when the hormones go off, you're going to notice it. Like you mentioned, things like severe PMS or PCOS, or for men, low testosterone, low energy, low libido, all those kind of things. Like, those are the thing that gets noticed. And it might be that the hormone deficiency or imbalance that's causing that, but something is upstream contributing to that. So we might talk about that a little bit. I think that for most of our audience is kind of in that middle-aged category where, you know, you start to notice stuff just isn't the same as it was, or something feels a little different. And also for women, I've noticed that at least in the US and in most Western culture, like having horrific PMS symptoms and pain and all of that has kind of just been accepted as the normal thing that everyone gets to go through. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about how that actually doesn't have to be. So, but today we're primarily going to talk about hormone testing. We do have some training videos that I can link on here that go through a lot more topics that we're kind of pointing to right now. But the main methods of hormone testing, what are the primary ways that hormones get tested?
So you have gold standard, just based on the amount of volume of studies, is really your blood test, right? Called a serum test. You also have salivary testing, and then you have urine testing. And those are going to be your three categories.
Okay. And let's start at the top. Let's talk about the blood testing, because that's probably the one that most people are familiar with or have done before. If they're going to conventional health practitioners, that's probably the one that they're going to get run on them, more than likely an incomplete blood panel, but still, what does blood testing for sex hormones look like, and what are the pros and cons of it?
Well, we have to start with what is a sex hormone, and sex hormones are a little different than other hormones in that they're cholesterol-based, meaning that they're really going to be lipophobic. So they need fat in order to kind of be brought in and utilized. And so in water and serum, blood is a lot of water, right? They don't tend to carry as easily, so they have to be bound to protein. So when you're looking at blood, you're really looking at protein-bound hormone. Granted, the bulk of hormone produced that gets excreted from our gonadal tissue, so gonads are anything that are gamete-producing, so the testicles and the ovaries, right? Or adrenals or adipose, those are our primary hormone producing tissues.
Adipose is fat tissue, yeah? Our fat tissue actually produces hormones.
It does. It both stores and produces hormone. Yep. And in postmenopausal women, it becomes one of the primary sources of sex hormone.
Very interesting. Okay. I just wanted to catch that, make sure people heard that, because I don't think most people know that. I think that they think of the sex organs specifically when it comes to hormones, but they don't realize that the body fat itself produces hormones, which is probably why when people get really overweight, there's like this cyclical situation with hormones. So I'll cue that up if we get a chance to talk about it further, but the hormones are bound to proteins so that they can get into cells, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they have to, all of our sex hormones work primarily intracellular, so inside the cell. Because they're a fat, they can pass right in when they're unbound from protein. But to be carried and to extend their half-life, because really they don't, once they're made, they don't live in the body for very long. They're going to go to their tissues, knock on the door, do their signals, tell the cell to do something new, depending on, you know, any sort of stressor, and then they get cleared out, right? And so for it to circulate longer so that it has a little more impact in the body, our body is wise, and we have these binding proteins. And that's what you're going to see in the blood, is you're going to see this cholesterol-based hormone bound to a protein primarily, which is the bulk of the hormone, right? Because that's what's out in circulation. So it is an important viewpoint, but you have to remember it's a single point in time. Our hormones fluctuate a lot. And if you go into the slides from our previous talk, you can see the pictures of how kind of bouncy hormones really are throughout the day. So if you're taking a single point in time, are you getting a peak or a trough or an average? We don't know. And it's invasive, right? You have to get a blood draw. Not a lot of people like needles.
As someone with a severe needle phobia, I will speak up on behalf of all of those people. I have to have my a medical phlebotomy done next week because I have hemochromatosis, and one of the only ways to treat high iron is to do bloodletting.
Yeah.
And I'm already sweating and nervous and nauseous, and it's still a week away. So shout out to all you needle phobia people out there.
It's real.
But,
it's a real phobia.
So, but yeah, you're talking about, it is, it's terrifying. Like, and if anybody out there's ever passed out before for any reason, passing out is like the worst feeling. Like you literally feel like you're going to die. So And just walking into something, doing it intentionally, knowing that's going to happen is really difficult. And it's a cosmic joke of the universe. I say that the one health condition that I have, the only way to treat it is with the thing that I'm most afraid of in the whole world. Like, I'd rather just line up and get kicked in the shin for an hour than go do that. And so it's kind of funny to everyone except me. But I like how you mentioned it's a snapshot in time. So if you test, we'll just use testosterone, for example. It probably doesn't fluctuate quite as much as some of the estrogen and progesterone does, but what would be the difference if you tested in the blood for these bound, free-floating, or floating around bound to protein testosterone in the blood? What would be the difference if you tested it, say, at 8 a.m. versus 8 p.m.?
So it's a very different view. So when in the morning, growth hormone from our brain pulsates, and it's getting us ready for the day, right? We need our hormones to be virile and strong and energetic. So all of our hormones get this larger pulsation in the morning as growth hormone surges. So testosterone is no exception. It's going to surge significantly in the morning before 11 a.m. So you really want to test blood. And that's where all the studies are when we determine range for optimal testosterone. It's a morning sample because that's when it should be peaking. It kind of drops throughout the day. It gets a second little rise around 4 p.m.-ish, kind of 4 to 6. But then it just drops until it's at its lowest point right before bedtime. So if you're taking a sample at 8 p.m., you're getting closer and closer to bedtime. It's dark out. All of our hormones are kind of going down, getting ready for sleep. That's a time that we're resting. We don't need to be virile. So testosterone drops. So you might get a very false low value if you collect at night and think, oh, I have to be on testosterone, when no, you don't. You know, you actually are just physiologically responding.
And if you took it in the afternoon too, it could be a really low reading. And so that's a daily cycle for a hormone. And then for women's hormones with the estrogen and progesterone, it depends a lot when in their cycle or when in the month, not only when in the day, but when in the month that draw is done. And so it's almost impossible to get some semblance of snapshot of like, what does their full cycle look like? How is their hormone balance, we'll call it, by taking one blood test during the month, right?
Right. Yes. It can give you indicators, and you do need to make sure that you're collecting at the right time for the right hormone. And you need to know what you're looking for at that time of the month with that hormone range, right? Okay. So when you're looking at estrogen, it should be very low in the beginning of the month because you haven't yet developed that womb. You're still sloughing off. You're still having your menstrual cycle. Everything should be quite low. And then mid-cycle, you're surging to 3 to 4 times higher than you will be at any other point throughout the month for about 24 to 48 hours. As early, like as low as 12 hours. So 12 to 48 hours, you get this surge. And then it comes back down, and then you get another little rise. So you really have to know, when I collect in relationship, and what does that mean?
Yeah. Okay. So it requires quite a bit of self-awareness. And
yeah, I suggest every single woman of cycling age with a menstrual cycle track her cycles. There are free trackers out there. Just start, hit day one is the first day of your menstrual bleed. And then last day is when you're no longer having any bleed. Start collecting that data and then see how long your cycles are and where you are. And it really gives you a lot of great insight.
Good tip. Yeah. So those are, I mean, that's a bit of what the blood testing is. And those are actually some cons for it, is that it's really difficult to kind of pinpoint and get a bigger picture. The pros of blood testing would be what? It's been around a long time. It's probably pretty accurate regarding when it's testing. It's usually covered, or it's usually your doctor, if you have insurance, and like it's going to cover it. So it's kind of low out-of-pocket costs usually.
And every physician out there knows what to do with a blood test. Yeah, you come to a doctor, a conventional medical doctor, with a salivary or a urine test, and they're just going to throw it away because they're like, I don't know what to do with this information. Whereas if you have a blood test, they'll say, oh, okay, this is what this means through their lens.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, and you mentioned salivary. I was trained a bit in salivary hormone testing when I went through functional diagnostic nutrition practitioner training a lot of years ago now, so I won't pretend to be an expert on it, but even when I went through training on it, it never caught me personally, aside from maybe for adrenal hormone like cortisol, as something that's very like a top level choice. What is the lowdown on salivary testing?
You know, salivary testing, you're collecting, it's truly free hormone. Because sex hormones are water phobic, right? They don't like water. They're going to repel it. Saliva is a little more lipid based. So you do see a little more of that hormone circulating truly unbound. Now, the downside is we don't really have solid reference ranges established for saliva. So what do we do with that information? And for a long time, salivary testing was through ELISA or immunoassay, which is a kind of a low sensitivity, low specificity. So you just, it's like throwing a dart at a dartboard and saying, if it hits anywhere on the dartboard, we're good. And if it hits outside the dartboard, then yeah, there's probably a problem. But if you're looking for that specificity or sensitivity, you want to get close to where you, like, you either want to make sure you're getting the same mark every time or you're getting the bullseye every time. And salivary testing hasn't confirmed that as well within their testing margin. Now, I will say LCMS, which is like your top of the line way to really get sensitive and specific data, is becoming more and more affordable. And more labs are converting their salivary tests to LCMS. But reference ranges aren't updating as well. So I think there really is room for improvement in terms of like, what do we do with this population data? And what does this really mean with this info? Salivary testing is non-invasive, right? You just have to drool into a tube. So there's not the poke, you know, so there is that benefit as well. And you can take multiple samples throughout the day. So you can, kind of similar to urine, you can see a broader picture of what's happening. But again, it's bioavailable hormone. Do we know if it got into the cell? I don't know. Is it all the production of the hormone? No, it's not the protein bound, right? And so there's like, it's like this in between of what is it really? You know, what is it giving us in terms of value? I think it can be helpful if a woman is not on any hormones or if a male is not on any hormones. And there's a lot of interfering factors. So you, like gingivitis, for example, will over amplify certain hormones, especially testosterone. Oh,
interesting.
Yeah. So if you have any inflammation in the gums, because it's an anabolic hormone. And so it's going to express freely into that tissue in the mouth to try to heal and support the immune system. Well, but does that mean that you're actually making a lot of testosterone?
Yeah, does that mean there's more testosterone in the rest of the body, or does it just mean it's really excited in your mouth?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And so I mentioned,
like, what are we looking at?
we're not talking a lot about cortisol or stress hormones in this conversation, but I think that people that are listening to this might be familiar with salivary testing for cortisol. Do you want to drop a little bonus feedback here for that?
Absolutely. Salivary cortisol is your gold standard for cortisol measurement. Number one, you get a diurnal sampling because you can collect first thing in the morning. You can do serial collections throughout the day at various time intervals, depending on what you're trying to gather. They have validated that one very well for a very long time. So we know what to do with that information. And we know that it truly does reflect, because that is a short-lived, primarily non-protein bound. Now, we do know that there is cortisol binding globulin, there is albumin that carries it around, but primarily what we see coming through the saliva does reflect that free fraction that's actually getting used by the body.
And okay, that does. So cortisol is a little more straightforward from creation to use than the sex hormones have a little bit. They require the carrying, they require the fat. Cortisol, how does it feel about fat and water? What's its preference?
Well, it is also a cholesterol-based hormone, okay. So it is going to be a water phobic. So in serum, not as great a way to collect that cortisol, yeah, although
so
a lot of people
be
will
better.
Still use them. Yeah, saliva is better for that.
And then the overall pro of saliva testing, one of them is that it's easy and non-invasive. You could do it any time of day. It's really simple, right?
Okay. Yeah, you can collect and you can gather as many samples as you want. So if you're like, oh, I feel really stressed in midday around 3 p.m., collect a sample. You know, they're cheap. They're easy to collect. You can send as many or as few samples to the lab as you're looking for. As long as your doctor knows when that sample was collected and what to do with that information, you have good data.
Okay. And then that brings us.
Although I will say. Oh, go ahead. Just one caveat to anything hormone in saliva, topical hormones overinflate salivary levels. And when you're looking at like topical estrogen and you're looking at saliva or progesterone for that matter, you get really high levels in salivary testing that does not reflect what's actually in the tissues. Same thing goes with cortisol. If you're using a topical like hydrocortisone cream or Cortef or, you know, for a bug bite or a rash or poison ivy, that's, you don't want to test close to when you've applied that. And I've actually even had samples where patients are collecting salivary and they just put the tube on a counter that had some cortisone cream that's over the counter here in the States. And it just got enough. It just takes a little bit to overinflate that value in saliva. So you can get falsely elevated levels if you're using topical hormones and you're looking at saliva.
Wow. Okay. Good to know. Feel free to cut me off anytime I'm jumping along too quickly and I miss something that's absolutely expected and needed. So we've covered blood testing and saliva testing, and it's good to know about the topicals throwing that off and different things that'll mess that up. That leaves us with urine testing. And where should we start with that? What do you want to share about urine testing for hormones? This is not as traditional, I would call it, as blood. It's kind of newer, the newer kid on the block. So let's just jump into what the, or maybe just the widespread knowledge of it is newer. Because when I first learned about it about 10 years ago, barely anybody was talking about it. And now, at least in the functional world, urine testing has kind of taken front stage. So what can you share with about urine testing for sex hormones?
Yes. So I'm fascinated with urine testing because it shows behavior of hormones. It's not just your absolute value, right? It's not just the circulating level that you see in the blood or the free fraction that you see in saliva. It's actually showing you metabolites. And those are breakdowns of hormone. And how a hormone breaks down can indicate how a cell is stressed or not, how the body is responding to that hormone. Right. And it can show us metabolic parameters that can tell us, oh, this might be why you're symptomatic. Right. So, hey, you might have totally normal estrogen, but you're not breaking it into this metabolite that we would expect, meaning that you're backlogging it. It's causing more trouble inside the cell, causing more proliferation. And that could make you more symptomatic with heavy periods or with PMS or fibrocystic breasts or endometriosis for that matter, or PCOS. You know, it can make the symptoms worse based on how that hormone is behaving. So it's a picture of clearance, but it's water. Right. And so, again, we're looking at water phobic hormone to get into urine. Two things have to be true. Number one, it has to be bioavailable. It has to have passed through the cell and got a sulfur group added to it so that it can be captured into that urine medium, which is kind of a fascinating view because it means it's not what's in circulation protein bound and it's not what's free and not in tissue, right? So protein bound is the blood, free but not in tissue is saliva. This is free and passed into the cell. That's urine. And then you get to see that breakdown. So where did it go? Where did that hormone transfer into? How did it break into its subsets? Because a fat has to become water soluble to excrete out of our body. So you can see that process of what we call phase one and phase two detox. How is it passing through the liver? How is it processing out into the urine? So fascinating view.
Yeah, it's interesting because then you can kind of see, you're seeing the hormone that's been used. You're seeing the hormone that's already done its thing and how it did its thing and then how it was metabolized afterwards. And it's more of the after. So there's the before when it's floating around. Then there's the during, which we don't really have a solid way to look at. It's pretty invasive and difficult to find out hormone levels in tissue. I don't even want to know what that would look like. I'm picturing like they did. Here's my ADD. When I was in grad school, I have a master's in exercise physiology, and at USF, when I started grad school in Tampa, they do muscle biopsies to determine muscle fiber type percentage breakdowns in people, like athletes. Like if they want to know like what muscle fiber types, because you know, type one are this, and one is more sprinting and explosive force and power, and then the other is more like endurance. And if you see a marathon runner next to a sprinter, that's a pretty good example of like what's one type of muscle fiber, what's the other type. And they kept talking about this in class about muscle fiber biopsies to like test this. And I'm thinking like, does that mean what I think it means? And so then I was the one that raised my hand and was like, hey, how do you do that? And they're like, do you want to come find out? Do you want to do it? And I was like, I don't think so, because I'm terrified of needles. And that sounds like, and it was actually like one of the most terrifying needles I've ever seen that actually has a hook on the end of it that
and
grabs
four.
Nasty, like I couldn't believe it was a real thing that they showed me. I was like, who lets you do this to them? And they'd be like, people who aren't afraid of it. I'm like, there's nobody who's not afraid of that thing. And they say, well, we don't like wave it in their face before we do it. But anyways, that's what I'm picturing when it comes to trying to test a hormone that's inside tissue or cells. So the, is there,
I'll give you a cool example, because there are, there's ways that you can tell if a hormone is getting into a tissue and responding correctly to that tissue. And one of the best ways in women, for example, is looking at progesterone. And this is where you can kind of see the limitations of salivary testing, really all testing. So when you're looking at ways that, and this actually could be a good segue into bioidenticals, but if you're, if a woman is taking bioidentical progesterone, there's multiple ways that she could take it. She could take it as an oral capsule. She could take it as a drop or a troche, like a little sublingual under the tongue. Mm-hmm. She can take it as a vaginal application, or she can take it as a topical cream, right, on the skin. Now, a lot of providers will use the topical cream. In the States, it's over the counter. And so it can be readily accessible. A lot of different types of providers can recommend it. It can improve symptoms to a small degree. But here's the kicker. If you have a postmenopausal woman and she still has a uterus, she is not making any of her own sex hormones to any significant degree anymore. Her hormone factories have gone into retirement, right? Her ovaries are no longer communicating with her brain. So the bulk of her hormone, what little she makes,
hold on, is that what happens?
From. Yeah. Yeah.
They just stop communicating with the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Like the signal gets disconnected.
This is why one of the markers.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So the ovaries are just like, we have
no eggs left. But I didn't know like what the mechanism is or where the instructions come from. And it's just that it ceases to get instructions.
Right. And it's really from feedback. So the ovary's like, we have no more eggs left that are viable. Like, we can't keep kicking this out. And so the brain's like, okay, well, we'll try. We'll keep knocking, you know? And then the ovaries are like, nope, we've got to stop that communication. We're not going to open the door anymore.
So the ovaries shut off the communication.
Yep.
Interesting.
They say, we've got no more eggs.
There's another ADD attack, but that seems relevant. I don't think most people know that.
Absolutely.
So continue with your topicals for... You were talking about topicals.
So women, yep. So once those ovaries are offline, again, women can still make a small fraction of hormone from fat tissue and a lot from adrenals, but a lot of that hormone is going to be pretty inactive, right? And so this is why women are at greater risk for osteopenia and osteoporosis, because estrogen is such an important hormone for bone growth and turnover. Really, all of our sex hormones have a role, but estrogen's a big one. And so when you're seeing that kind of decline, a lot of doctors can choose to bring in bioidentical estrogen and progesterone. If you still have a uterus, you do need to have progesterone to offset the growth and proliferation of estrogen on the uterine tissue, right? Because one of the roles estrogen plays when we're cycling is to develop a womb. So it grows, I call it the bricks. It creates bricks in the uterus to kind of build up a wall. And then we have our menstrual cycle, the bricks fall off, and you bleed. Progesterone is the mortar that holds those bricks together. So it's really giving integrity to that. So if you gave a woman with a uterus who doesn't make any progesterone on her own, estrogen, she's going to make a lot of bricks, and that can be dangerous, right? And so we have to give progesterone as well to protect that uterine tissue. Again, a lot of docs will choose, or not, I shouldn't say a lot, but docs can choose topical progesterone. Now, if a doc is choosing topical progesterone and tests in saliva, they're going to see really, really high levels of progesterone. That doesn't necessarily mean that the tissue is getting that progesterone. And we know this because of a tissue biopsy, because you can test uterine tissue and you can biopsy it pretty easily. It's very, I mean, it's invasive, but it's not a muscle biopsy. It's not a big bore, right? It's
no
just
giant
a little
hook
tool
needle
that
from hell. No. Okay.
Yeah. No, none of that.
Okay. Good.
So you can do two ways. You can look at what they call the endometrial stripe, which is the level or degree of thickness of that endometrial tissue. And that's an ultrasound. So minimally invasive. They can also do a biopsy, which is a little more invasive, but again, not a huge stab or anything. It's just a little scraping of the tissue. And what they've found is that if you use topical hormone, you don't get uterine protection. It's not getting to that tissue. And yet you test saliva and you say, but they are on, they have a ton of progesterone. What's going on?
And then they probably even lower the topical progesterone, seeing the high score on the saliva, which means even less would be getting anywhere.
Exactly. And this is the conundrum there. And that's why we say, you know, A, we know that it's oral or vaginal progesterone that protects the endometrial tissue. That's going to be the type of progesterone you need if you're going to be on bioidentical estrogen. It's the type we know protects based on those studies, based on those imaging studies and biopsies. And saliva, we know, then overinflates what we're seeing, whereas urine under represents. Like, you look at urine and it's like, they have nothing. It's like, well, they probably have a little. It's just A, very short-lived, and B, not getting to the right tissues. It gets sequestered into the tissue you're applying it to, and it's not really having systemic action. So you don't get the sleep benefits that progesterone has when you use it topically, and you don't get the endometrial protection.
Okay. So, that's good to know. Anyway, I'm sure there's people, out there that this applies to. So we were talking about urine testing and how the blood and the saliva is a little bit more looking at where hormones are at before they go into the tissues or the cells. And then the urine testing allows you to see where they've, not necessarily where they've been, but that they've, how much hormone has been used, how much is actually functionally being used and then gone into tissues, and then what metabolites did it make? Because estrogen, and this would be a topic for a whole other podcast because it's quite in depth and complex, but estrogen gets vilified, you know, that estrogen is bad. And there are multiple forms of estrogen that end up being created once it is used. And some of them, I'll let you talk about it, but this is just my man understanding of it. Some of them, it's a balance, and you don't want one of them to be really high. And that is one that tends to be linked towards some disease processes. But then all of estrogen gets thrown under the bus. Did I man screw that up, or was that fairly accurate?
That was good. It was a good summary. Yeah, exactly. There are, we call them the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? As the metabolites. So when estrogen goes through phase one transformation, so we take that fat soluble hormone and we make it into water. It has, there's three primary enzymes. There's actually a few others that are involved as well, but the three primaries are part of what's called the CYP-P450 enzyme. Mm-hmm. So they're taking a cholesterol, making it water. And there's a good pathway, and that creates something called a 2-hydroxyestrogen. There's a bad pathway, and that's the 16-hydroxyestrogen. And then there's the ugly pathway, and that's the 4-hydroxyestrogen. The reason it's ugly is that that is the estrogen that really has to get methylated rapidly. And if it's not methylated and it just tains out in tissues, it can actually go into the nucleus and create little speed bumps on DNA. And we don't want speed bumps, right? Because the more speed bumps there are, the more errors there are when that DNA is replicating, and the more issue there can then become with that cell. And that can lead to cancer risk long-term. If you're not, if you don't have the right ways to clean up and break down those speed bumps or clear out that.
What determines, in short, sorry to interrupt, but I think this is important. What determines which way that the estrogen goes as far as good, bad, and ugly?
Yeah. And I should say the bad isn't really that bad. It's just tissue proliferative. It actually does protect the bone a little more when estrogens are super low. It's the next best option, but it doesn't create a tumor. But if a tumor is there, it can cause it to grow faster, right? So there's some negative to that 16-OH. But the thing that kind of dictates where estrogen will go, number one, is our genes. So how is our expression of these enzymes within our liver? Some people naturally favor a lot more of the 1A1, which most people should. That's going to be your most active highway, superhighway, right? For estrogen to kind of process out of the body. But there are people who do favor a little more expression of 1B1, and that's going to be more of that ugly, that 4-hydroxy. There's also the big one that increases expression of that enzyme. So the more expression there is, the more estrogen gets subject to go through to bypass into that path. The more expression can be upregulated by polyaromatic hydrocarbons. So these are smoke inhaled things, fire, smoked meats, barbecued meats, right, can increase expression of that enzyme. We have some xenoestrogens that will increase that expression. And then there are some medications that push that pathway as well. Blood sugars will push up that path a little bit. So,
okay.
Yeah, things that we can actually alter.
Those are all things that we can control to an extent. And we've hosted Laura Adler, who educates on environmental toxicity, a bunch of times. And she actually did a presentation for one of our masterclasses purely on endocrine disrupting chemicals. And she talked quite a bit about that and how many there are and the effects that they have. And it's interesting because they bind to different receptors or block receptors, or it's just things our body isn't designed to have in it. That confuse the system and kind of throw sand in the gears. So that's a good breakdown of estrogen. Now, what's the value of with urine testing, seeing those metabolites, seeing the post-use, essentially, of the hormones, that's not how much I have circulating. That's not how much I have in the tissue. Like, why is it so cool to see and valuable, like clinically valuable to see the metabolites, the way the hormones have been transmuted, I don't know, changed and eliminated. Why is that so valuable?
It's valuable because it's telling us how that hormone is behaving within the cell. So remember, hormones act within a cell. And they're acting on the nucleus to say, hey, we need to upregulate these proteins. We need to increase proliferation of endometrial tissue, right? We need to increase proliferation of skeletal muscle. We need to increase response to blood sugars, right? So these are all roles. Neurotransmitters are controlled by some of our hormones as well. So when you're looking at that intracellular behavior, we want to say, okay, how much is getting into the cell? How is it getting utilized? And is it going into those dangerous pathways or is it getting processed out really efficiently? And then phase two. So I always think about phase one is kind of sweeping up, right, that estrogen into three different piles. Phase two is putting it into garbage bags. And those garbage bags, like the rate of clearance, that can also kind of inform us not only on hormone behavior, but on other things that are dependent on those garbage bags, right? So like neurotransmitters like dopamine and norepinephrine, for example. So you can really start to say, okay, if they're pushing down, you know, this bad pathway, this 4-hydroxy pathway, and their methyl response, because we know 4-hydroxy then has to methylate to 4-methoxy, if that's not happening, that increases the danger of 4-hydroxy. That increases those addicts, those speed bumps on DNA. We want to know that because we can alter that cell behavior. We can say, okay, now we can intervene and we can give you antioxidants. We can reduce the environmental toxins. We can help you detox more efficiently and help you methylate more correctly, right? We can also infer, you know, if someone's like, oh, I get the worst, you know, anxiety right around my cycles, but estrogen itself is not that high and they're poor methylators. Well, they may not just be poor methylators for estrogen, and that could be a problem, but they could also be poorly methylating dopamine, and that's going to create a lot more anxiety around their cycle. Women, even with perfect, so COMT, the catecholaminomethyltransferase enzyme, is the really the methyl detox enzyme that's donating SAMe to our estrogens. And even with perfect function of that enzyme, even with rapid type, right, the valine type variant of that, women are naturally slower through that pathway because of the amount of estrogen burden they have. So it's just, it's a good one to check on and say, okay, what's your rate of clearance? And is it processing out? And could this be contributing to other things in your body not working as well?
Okay.
If so that answers that question.
Gives a lot, well, it gives a lot more like actionable steps, basically, like things that you can do to intervene to increase or decrease certain enzyme expression and other things that are going to dictate how the hormones are being used and not only used, but produced as well to an extent. But because if not very many are coming out, that's probably a pretty good indicator, which you could verify with blood testing and everything else, that not many are being produced. So, okay.
Yeah, having the two kind of gives you the full story. And it's nice to complement those two because then you see what's in circulation, what was excreted, and how does that relate to one another?
How often, maybe for, yeah, how often retesting? So running, getting a baseline of hormone testing. And a lot of people, if they're working with practitioners, the practitioner should be pretty up to speed on this. So this should not necessarily be the responsibility of the patient, but our audience really likes to be self-advocates, which a lot of times, depending on the practitioner, is a good thing. So how often do you recommend that people retest their hormones if they're working on like an imbalance or discrepancies?
So it really takes around 3 months to see any noticeable change and around 6 months to solidify that change. So if you're doing it, if you're intervening with a supplement or a hormone bioidentical or even lifestyle changes, within 3 months, you'll see how that's impacting the enzymatic response. But really, it's that 6 month testing window that you want to collect within. So I always say 3 to 6 months, depending on your symptom response, right? If you're not seeing any changes by that 3 month mark, probably want to retest and make sure that the interventions you're doing are actually augmenting the right enzymes. But if things are starting to shift and change, don't retest until that 6 month mark, because that's really when you'll see, okay, this is now how I'm functioning based on what I've done.
Okay.
That said, in serum, if you're adding in especially bioidentical hormones, every 6 weeks you should be testing the blood, because that's telling us, okay, what level are we getting you into for circulation in terms of that hormone? We don't want to overshoot it too quickly. So kind of variations in the two tests.
Okay, that makes sense. I had a few other questions, but I really want to be able to talk about what you're doing now. And so I'm going to go into that. And I have one request that I'm going to put you on the spot for that I did not warn her ahead of time about. I'll do that last, just to make you nervous while you're answering these other questions. EndoAxis is I don't know whether to call it a platform or a software or a company or a service or a yes to all of those things. Yeah. And we've hosted you on a webinar before. Kieran, who everybody knows in our audience, is involved with EndoAxis and his partner, Tom. And what you guys have done in my, again, I'll give the layman caveman version of it, and you can correct me, is that Dutch testing is the gold standard for urine, basically for urine hormone testing, sex hormone testing that's out there. And it's great. And it's quite complex to interpret. And I used to run them when I was working with clients. I would make good use of calling them to say, help me. I don't really know what I'm doing with this. And that's the case with a lot of practitioners. So they know that it's the best. Somebody's taught them about Dutch. They're sold on it. They're like, this is really valuable testing. I'm going to run these on all of my patients and all of my clients. And then, wow, I get this really in-depth report that I'm not really sure entirely how to make sense of. And what you guys have done is kind of solved that problem by taking your years of experience and knowledge and everything in regards to interpreting these Dutch test reports, plugged it into an incredibly intelligent system that then takes the results and gives them very, very customized, actionable recommendations. How did I do?
Yes. So we are taking that complex hormone view. And we're saying not only what are your hormones and their metabolites and what does that mean, but we're relating them to one another. So we've taken calculations and relationships between the hormones to really say, here is the metabolic undercurrent of what's going on within that hormonal expression and how you can alter it through lifestyle, through supplementation. There's 236 female patterns and 96 male patterns and 13 adrenal patterns so far.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 236 to 96. That's the complexity difference between women and men, right? That's the joke. It's 2.5 to 1. But that's a lot of different pattern combinations of hormone imbalances. And they formulated a bunch of very specific natural supplements that help. And these are not, you're not giving people hormones. Can you just explain a little bit about the formulas and why you created them like you did and how they work?
So these formulas are really, they were inspired by the why, not the what. So a lot of formulations out there are saying, here, this is for your estrogen detox. And they give kind of the kitchen sink for all the things that can support estrogen detox. But they're not really focused on any one or two pathways of clearance. By looking at your estrogen clearance, if we're saying, oh, you really need help with phase 1 and phase 3, which is your gut, right? Taking those trash bags to the dump. If we're saying that's really the focus here, well, we have the product that's going to focus heavily on those and give a little of additional support, because we always want to support all three phases of detox, but it's really going to focus on the right phase for that person. And it's looking at different enzymes involved in like relationships between estrogen and progesterone, in testosterone estrogen relationships, and in testosterone clearance, and saying, hey, if you're pushing a lot towards 5-alpha reductase, for example, this is another enzyme within the cell that increases in response to blood sugar imbalances, to inflammation, to high stress. If we're seeing that pathway and we say, okay, this person's also experiencing acne or that kind of androgenic or like testosterone-based hair loss, or they get really oily skin or very agitated. Well, here's a product that we know, like that enzyme's likely impacting them metabolically. We see it's being pushed. We can give them targeted nutrients that support neurological health, but also so it kind of calms down, it reduces that anxiety side, but it's also supporting all of their androgenic metabolites and saying, let's push them a little more evenly to 5-beta and alpha to downregulate how tissue active they are. So saying we can kind of support and reduce the acne flares by giving them this product, knowing that, you know, we're treating all the causes of why that enzyme would be upregulated, not just inhibitors of the enzyme. right? Which is the common approach.
Yeah. It makes total sense. And I love your just simple way of saying that you're addressing the why, not the what. Because addressing the what is kind of whack-a-mole, sort of, where figuring out why the moles are popping up in the first place, shutting off the machine from down below, probably more effective than continually whacking the thing as it comes up. And a lot of these didn't exist. These like you mentioned, a lot of the products I've seen related to hormones are like kitchen sink products with like 92 ingredients in them. And like, they all on their own have great studies showing it can help this problem or this problem or this thing or this thing or this thing, but no one has that exact combination of things that they need usually. So then you end up taking a bunch of stuff you don't really need and spending a lot of money you don't really need to be spending. And then there's the possibility that certain things can push stuff in a direction that you don't want it to if you don't know the specifics of what your situation is. So giving people these actionable steps with very focused ways to modify it and to kind of push them in the right direction is really helpful and really helps the practitioners too to hone in for their clients and patients. So if you're a practitioner listening to this, what do the practitioners do? Just go to your website and create an account. It's endoaxis.com.
Endoaxis.com. Sign up to be a provider. We are right now limiting to 500 docs utilizing the platform because we are putting eyes on every single report coming through. So we just want to make sure that we're getting the right utilization, but we are going to be opening that up to automation very shortly. So definitely go in, sign up as a provider, and you'll have access into the account in addition to not just uploading Dutch, but also all of our research, all of our herbal monographs, all of our, we have a conditions database as well within our education center. So we really want providers to feel well equipped to manage hormones in a very comprehensive way.
Okay.
And it's all free.
It's brilliant. And it costs nothing. So that's a perk. So you don't have to, that's not going to get passed along to the consumer because these tests are, you know, aren't cheap to begin with. So like it doesn't add any extra cost. And if you're not a practitioner and you're somebody in our audience that's kind of a DIY health person, or you're somebody that's your own advocate, or you're working with a practitioner who doesn't have a Dutch account, we also have made this testing available through our platform and our practitioner that goes through and reviews the reports. And we even offer like a video interpretation of the report that you're getting from EndoAxis on top of it. So we'll have the links to all of that down below in the show notes and in the links on here. If you want to check that out. And we have a webinar that we'll link there too that we did that's purely on EndoAxis that has Dr. Liz and Kiran, and it's great and super informative. So we'll link all that below if you want to learn more about that. And then the question to put you on the spot, and I only have 2 minutes because I have another recording, so it won't go too long, is a couple, 2 to 3 of your favorite tips or suggestions you can offer people that can help in either hormone production or hormone balance or just overall the why behind the what. So, and these can be really basic, they could be really simple, they could be broad, or it could be something specific you like to tell people.
I mean, it really does come down to the basics. If you want your hormones to be optimal and you want to function at your best, sleep is number one. You have to be sleeping well. You have to wake up refreshed, right? Anything you can do to improve your sleep and improve your stress throughout the day and balance blood sugars. I mean, that really is the key. When we look at, I feel like it's almost a broken record in the report sometimes when we're saying like, oh, this enzyme is upregulated and we're seeing higher hormone production. And this is the cause, high blood sugar, hyperinsulinemia. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, and this one's also elevated, also from high blood sugar and hyperinsulinemia. Yeah. And then all the other factors. But those are like the number one for so many enzymes to increase expression that then negatively impact our hormones. So blood sugar regulation, eat protein, move your body, sleep well, manage stress, and your hormones really will function at their best. Easier said than done.
And then we've got you guys there for the testing and the more intricate adjustments and things for people who need it too. So it's thank you, Dr. Liz, for sharing your wealth of information. And I know that we could have gone way deeper into a lot of these topics, and we have on a couple other training videos. So we'll link everything down below if you want to explore this more, if you want to explore EndoAxis more, if you want to get some testing done. And we will edit this. Don't worry. Hey, Sylvia, could you jump out real quick? I'm finishing my previous recording real quick. No worries. Come back in like 2 minutes. Thanks. We can edit all of this. I had no idea that was even possible. So
that's a good time to learn.
No big deal. Hold on. Okay. Let me see. Oops. Now Akina's jumping in. Hold on. We're just finishing my last recording. So I'm going to hide real quick for a second. Can you come back in like 2 minutes? Sorry, I were running a little late. I didn't know people could jump in while we were recording on Zoom. On Zoom, you have to admit people, and on this, they just like appear. So there's a leave. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's new. So I'm going to clap. Because that gives a spike in the audio file image so they know where to go to do the editing. And, okay, let's redo. I'll start from, I know that there's more that we could have talked about and to go look for the other things. You already answered the question. So, and there's so much more that we could have talked about with some of these things. We have deep dive trainings with you, other webinars about EndoAxis specifically. So feel free to check out the links down below and go ahead out and check out more stuff if you're interested in this topic and want to get some testing run. And Dr. Liz, thank you so much as always for coming on and for sharing your wealth of knowledge with our audience.
Thank you so much for hosting me. This was a pleasure. And yeah, I look forward to it anytime in the future.
Definitely. Thanks.